So, hi everyone. I just wanted to first start by thanking the organizers for a fantastic meeting and for the invitation to be here. It's been really great and I've learned so much, so thank you for that. Again, my name is Karen Ryan. I'm an assistant professor in the Metabolic Diseases Institute in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at the University of Cincinnati. And my research there really aims to understand proximate behavioral, physiological, and molecular mechanisms that underlie what we all understand is this ongoing obesity epidemic that has been referred to a couple of times at this meeting. So, you know, we're sort of bombarded in the media with information about how populations, particularly in the United States and other Western countries, are becoming obese at a very rapid pace. And for those of you who aren't used to thinking about this, I thought it would be useful to sort of show you the progression of this epidemic in the U.S. So these are a series of maps that you can find on the Centers for Disease Control website, which illustrate the incidence of obesity or having a BMI of greater than 30 among adults in the United States over the past 20 to 25 years. So in 1990, what you'll note is that, I mean, this wasn't very long ago, but the average incidence of obesity among adults in the U.S. then was less than 15%. So even states like Mississippi and Alabama, which now have really high obesity incidence, were relatively low. So if we continue on to 1995, what you'll see if we've added a new category to our graph or our map here, and many states are falling into this category of having 15 to 19% of the adult population having a BMI of greater than 30. If we continue to 2000, we've added yet another category here of individuals who are states in which greater than 20% of the adult population are obese. Continue on to 2005, and we've added two new categories, right? So states with this dark red have greater than 30% of the adult population obese, and in the lighter orange, greater than 25%. And you'll notice we only have a few holdouts that are still blue, right? So even the states that are lagging behind are still rapidly increasing the incidence of obesity. And finally, in 2010, which is the last map that's available, there's no more blue left anywhere in the US, unfortunately, where if you remember as recently as 1990, all of the states were falling into these categories. And a large swath of, especially the southern US, have an incidence of obesity among adults of greater than 30%. So this really represents a public health crisis because obesity is associated with numerous important medical complications. I won't list them here. Today, I'm mostly going to discuss particular metabolic diseases, including type 2 diabetes, for which obesity is a significant risk factor. So this map, also from the CDC, illustrates the estimates of diagnosed diabetes, which is certainly an underestimate of the actual incidence of diabetes among adults greater than 20 years in 2010. And of course, if you overlay this on the obesity maps, you see a pretty good correspondence because, again, obesity is a really important risk factor for diabetes. In addition, obesity is a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And again, we can see that the maps would overlay. So here you're looking at the incidence of heart disease deaths among women ages 35 and over between 2008 and 2010. And again, this is showing a similar distribution to the incidence of obesity. So I'll back up by saying that, of course, you know, I just showed you that this epidemic has really occurred over a relatively short time frame. And therefore, although it's certainly true that our genetic background can influence our susceptibility to becoming obese, certainly changes in gene frequencies over this time are not the primary drivers, and we have to invoke some kind of gene by environment interaction. And so really what my research in Cincinnati aims to understand is how environmental influences interact with our physiology to affect metabolic endpoints. And so a large portion of my research has focused on the effect of diet. So certainly one important potential driver of this obesity problem is the increased availability of low-cost, high-fat palatable foods like the Hardee's Double Double that you see here. And we know that animals and humans who consume these types of diets have a greatly increased risk for metabolic diseases, including obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Today's talk is going to focus primarily on another environmental influence that is thought to affect the progression and incidence of metabolic disease, and that's psychosocial stressors. So this has come up throughout the workshop that chronic exposure to these psychosocial stressors, including job stress, marital stress, stress that results from caregiving for a terminally ill or a chronically ill relative, is associated with significant increase in the risk of these metabolic diseases. And I'll just point out, of course, that these two things are not mutually exclusive, and there's lots of reasons to think that stress and feeding behavior can interact. And I won't touch too much on that today, but that's another line of work in my group. So this schematic sort of outlines the talk today. What I want to cover is potential physiological mechanisms that provide these links between life stress and metabolic disease. So first, I'll discuss some of the canonical stress responses. So this is activation of the HPA and sympathoadrenal medullary axis, which are linked to increased incidence of metabolic diseases. And then, as we've heard, chronic stress is associated with an increase in chronic low-grade inflammation, which is also linked to metabolic disease. And finally, sort of a new area of interest for me is a potential role for the gut microbial communities to provide a link here between canonical stress responses, inflammation, and metabolic disease. Okay, so just as a brief sort of recap, we all know that when an individual encounters a real or perceived stressor, this leads to activation of neurons in the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus and other preautonomic nuclei, which sort of activates a two-arm stress response. So most immediately is activation of the sympathetic nervous system, so the sympathoadrenomedullary axis. There's a withdrawal of parasympathetic and an increase of sympathetic drive. The increase of sympathetic drive to the adrenal medulla leads to a release of catecholamines. And together, these actions lead to an increase in heart rate and blood pressure. They induce lipolysis in white adipose tissue for the release of free fatty acids. And there's an increase in hepatic glucose production. In a slightly slower time frame, we have activation of the HPA axis. So CRH, of course, is produced in the PDN and released at the median eminence. Acts on the pituitary to release ACTH, which acts at the adrenal cortex to elicit the release of glucocorticoids. And among other things, glucocorticoids also increase lipolysis in white adipose tissue and increase hepatic gluconeogenesis. And so the net effect of this stress response is to commandeer metabolic circuits in order to mobilize fuels. And this allows the appropriate behavioral and physiological responses to the perceived stress. So to run away from the saber-toothed tiger, I guess, or to deal with an aggressive conspecific, or whatever the stressor might be, these stress responses are acting to mobilize fuels in an acute manner. However, under conditions of chronic stress, these frequent or persistent exposures to these processes can predispose to disease, and this is the idea of allostatic load. And we would propose that metabolic diseases might be particularly susceptible because, after all, it's these metabolic neuroendocrine circuits that are being persistently commandeered in the sort of the need to deal with an acute problem. So I guess first I'd like to talk about how chronic HPA activity might be linked to metabolic disease. This is primarily through the actions of glucocorticoids, which can act at receptors in the brain to promote increased energy intake. So here you're looking at data from a human study in which patients were baseline were fasted for, I think, overnight, and then their change in energy intake was measured over the following 4 days, either following ingestions of synthetic glucocorticoids or a vehicle. So the glucocorticoid values are in black, obviously, and you see that exposure to these glucocorticoids led to an increase in food intake. We also know that stress and glucocorticoid exposure can promote not only an increase in food intake in general, but the consumption of highly palatable foods. So this is the idea of comfort feeding. I think there is actually some good physiological evidence that consumption of highly palatable foods in response to stress can feed back to blunt stress responses. So driving this this sort of feed forward cycle, right? And finally, not only do glucocorticoids promote the increase in consumption of maybe not the most healthy foods, but they also promote the accumulation of body fat in visceral depots. So this is the idea, you know, of individuals who have more of an apple shape having storing in their adipose tissue in the viscera are much less metabolically healthy than individuals who store fat in subcutaneous depots. And this is because the visceral depots are surrounding our metabolically important organs like liver and leading to insulin resistance. So we also know that chronic sympathetic activity can be linked to metabolic disease. There's an abundance of evidence for this, but I'm just showing you data from one study done in cynomolgus monkeys. This is the paradigm in which individuals' social groups were shifted on a regular basis, such that dominant individuals tended to be under greater stress because they were engaging in more agonistic encounters. And this is associated with an increase in coronary atherosclerosis. And that effect could be blunted by treating the animals during this paradigm with beta adrenergic receptor blockade. So we know now that life stress can influence metabolic disease by acting directly through these canonical stress responses, but there's also a body of evidence suggesting that stress also regulates the innate immune response to increase chronic inflammation, which is known to impair insulin sensitivity and otherwise lead to an increased incidence of metabolic disease. So we know that the innate immune system can respond to a physical stressor of infection, and this occurs because lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, which is a lipid that's derived from bacterial walls, binds to and activates the toll-like receptor 4, shown here, which induces a cascade of events that produce an inflammatory response, including the activation of the receptor NF-kappa-B, which is responsible for increasing transcription of cytokines, things like IL-6, which are increased in response to LPS. So, interestingly, activation of the innate immune system also occurs following acute and chronic psychological stress, and this is thought, again, to be dependent on beta adrenergic signaling because it can be blocked with propranolol. And it also may be contributing to improved wound healing following stress. So there's some data from humans who have had knee surgery that individuals who have a greater autonomic response to an acute stress are also have improved wound healing or improved healing of their knees following surgery. So this is something that I was thinking about when we were talking about the baboon data earlier. So low-grade inflammation, there's a large and growing literature in the metabolism field about the role of low-grade chronic innate immune system activation, and it's linked to obesity and insulin resistance. And in this case, we know the origin of that inflammation because it turns out that not only can LPS, which is, again, a lipid derived from bacterial cell walls, bind to TLR4, but saturated fatty acids derived from our diets also can activate TLR4 to induce chronic inflammation. And moreover, we know that mice who have a knockout or a loss of function of the TLR4 receptor are buffered against the deleterious effects of these high-fat diets. So that's what you're looking at on the right. Let's see. So the C3HHEJ strain is a strain of mast that has a loss of function for TLR4. And if you look at the effect of feeding a high-fat diet here in those animals, it's significantly blunted relative to controls. And that was true for measures of glucose tolerance and insulin resistance as well. So here we know there's a link between inflammation and metabolic disease. We know there's a link between stress and inflammation, but it's not exactly clear what the origin of this inflammatory response is. It seems to be related to these canonical stress responses, but I've been recently interested, and I'll just say right now I don't have any data of my own to show you. I'm currently in the process of some of these experiments about whether or not there might be a role for modulation of gut microbial communities to contribute to the stress-induced activation of the innate immune system. So not only do LPS particles from pathogenic bacteria activate TLR4, but our commensal gut microbes could also have this effect. And so we know that psychosocial stress actually does alter gut microbial communities and increase inflammation. Here you're looking at a heat map of changes in the gut microbial communities in individuals who underwent a chronic social defeat type paradigm, and those are all clustering together here versus home cage controls. So there was this nice separation between the two groups, suggesting that there is an effect of this stress paradigm to alter gut microbial communities. And even more convincingly, the stress-associated activation of the innate immune system in these animals was prevented by an antibiotic treatment. So here you have the circulating IL-6 from home cage controls who received vehicle or antibiotic, no difference. When they're subjected to this chronic social stress paradigm, IL-6 is significantly increased in animals who receive vehicle, and then this is significantly blunted by the treatment with an antibiotic. And this was true in response to a restraint stressor as well. So this really suggests that, yes, chronic social stress can alter gut microbial communities, and that these changes may be contributing to increased inflammation following chronic social stress. And moreover, there's a rapidly growing literature that is linking the diversity of gut microbial communities to metabolic diseases. So this is a really hot topic in metabolism these days. It started with some studies that identified key differences in the gut microbiome of obese and lean twins. And moreover, when these gut microbiomes were inoculated to germ-free mice, it led to an increased capacity for storing calories. So if you inoculate a germ-free mouse with the microbiota of an obese animal, those mice gain more weight over the subsequent weeks relative to mice who were inoculated with the microbiota from a lean individual. This seems to be related to increased inflammation and can result in increase in obesity and diabetes. So recently there's been an interest in the role of the gut microbiota to facilitate the metabolic improvements that are observed following bariatric weight loss surgeries. So there are marked changes in gut microbial communities that occur following these surgeries, which is no surprise to any of the ecologists in the room, because the massive changes in the gut physiology will certainly be changing the local environmental conditions of the gut in major ways. And this seems to be functional, because if you inoculate germ-free mice with the gut microbiota from donor mice who have received a gastric bypass surgery, those animals gain less weight than mice who are inoculated with gut microbiota from animals who had a sham surgery. And more recently, some of our own work, which is not apparent from the title, identify a role for signaling by the bile acid receptor FXR to modulate some of these changes in gut microbial communities, and this leads to differences in the effectiveness of these surgeries. So in addition, there's this really interesting story about the role of gut microbial communities to facilitate the increase in atherosclerosis that occurs following among individuals who eat a lot of red meat. So essentially, if you compare the gut microbiome from vegetarians to omnivores, there is a selection for a group of microbes that metabolize L-carnitine, which is a nutrient that's found in red meat, and metabolites of these microbiota are linked to atherosclerosis. So just to walk you through what this study found was that consumption of carnitine and choline selected for changes in the gut flora that led to differences in the production of this metabolite TMA, which then acted in the vasculature to increase indices of atherosclerosis. And this is a really nice study because they had loss of function for all of these steps, really pinning down that this increase in atherosclerosis following these dietary supplements was depending on the gut microbes and on this particular metabolite. So, the next steps for me, anyway, are to ask whether or not stress-associated changes in the gut microbiota are linked not only with inflammation, but with the progression of metabolic disease in the rodent models that we have in our lab. And I guess now I will sort of sum up by sort of pointing out what I think are some interesting directions that may relate more toward the kind of work that you guys, many of you in this room, are doing. So we know that a lot of the work around stress and metabolic disease has focused on social stress in the realm of sort of agonistic and stressful relationships, but positive social relationships offer stress relief, as we heard about earlier in this meeting, and that this may reduce the risk of metabolic disease. And this may occur to in response to blended HPA and SAM responses. But in addition, it's possible that social connectedness could reduce disease risk by facilitating the transfer of commensal gut microbes. So there's this consistent finding in the gut microbiota literature that increasing microbial diversity is associated with improved indices of health. And so if it's true that individuals who have greater social connectedness have greater diversity of their gut microbes, this could be one mechanism facilitating the benefits of social interactions. And finally, we know that gut microbial communities are altered in pregnancy, and that babies are inoculated with the gut microbes of their, or with the microbes of their mother during childbirth. And this may, and because gut microbial communities are altered by stress, stress in pregnant mothers may be linked to disease states through changes in the founder populations of gut microbes in babies born to mothers who are under stress. So those are just some thoughts of how these topics could relate. And with that, I will end. And I guess the acknowledgments aren't really relevant, so thank you.